everyone. This is Simone Davis, and welcome to the Montessori Notebook Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I love getting to talk to you and make Montessori ideas accessible to anyone, and I hope that you've really been enjoying these conversations with so many people from around the world. And if you've been listening to the podcast from the beginning of the season, you'll know that Montessori isn't just an educational approach to be used into schools, but like the principles can be applied in our homes, and they don't require you to spend a lot of money or even have a lot of space. In fact, to me, I think Montessori is mostly about having respectful relationships with children and with others in our lives, and keeping our children's love of learning alive. So I think you'll love my conversation today with Nicole from Radical Beginnings. Nicole is also a toddler teacher like myself and has been working with toddlers for nearly 20 years. And so I got to ask her all your questions about tricky behavior, from getting kids to eat, to setting boundaries with them in a kind and loving way, and to getting rid of the battles while leaving somewhere, which I'm sure we've all had from time to time, or all the time, and what to do when they hit, bite, and throw. And I love that Nicole is so loving in the way that she respects the child, yet she's still the adult, and she's like the loving guide even in the difficult moments. So even if your children are older, the same principles apply at any age. So you're not going to want to miss the conversation later in the episode. But before I get to my conversation with Nicole, I'm getting asked a lot about setting up our homes in a more Montessori way, particularly if you're finding yourself at home a lot right now. So I thought today that it would be fun to give you some quick tips for setting up your home in a Montessori way. I know that that's where I started, and it really helped to put our family on the right path. So the first place I always start is by clearing away all the clutter and reducing the number of toys available. And I know that probably sounds quite scary to most of us, but it doesn't have to be. We can like completely remove everything like Marie Kondo style and then only put a few things back, or you can make it easier on yourself, and works for more people maybe, is to do it more gradually by placing just two cardboard boxes in the corner of the room where the children mostly have their toys. And as one box is going to be for the things that they've grown out of, for example, you can then keep them aside for younger child or pass them on to another family. And then the other box is going to be for things that they aren't using so much, but we can store them away for now and we'll rotate them in at another time. Then you leave out ideally around 6, maybe up to 12 activities per child, and the space is going to feel so much lighter and really is going to help your child choose something engaging. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but the less we have available, the more creative our children actually can be. So the next thing would then be to put as of these activities as much as possible, display them on an open shelf and not tucked away in a cupboard where things get piled on top of each other and you can't really see what's available, and not in a toy box. That's even harder because all of the pieces, you just lose them all the time. So I love using a low shelf that can be great for setting out some activities. But if your space doesn't allow for a shelf, you know, you can be creative. For example, you could use a low window ledge or along the edge of a rug, or even rotate things on a low table. A coffee table, for example, could be fine as well. And a phrase we love in Montessori is a place for everything and everything in its place. And when we have a special place for everything, this really helps our children learn easily where things belong. Like, for example, a place to put their shoes, a coat and bag by the front door. So that could be hooks, or just that they go in the same place every time. They always know where their toys are, their books and their favorite things. So that might be a little shelf, for example, in their bedroom. And then they learn where activities go back on the shelf when they're finished, and we can set up our homes much more intentionally, and we find that it helps to take the work out of constantly searching for missing things, and our children will become so much more capable and independent. As to which activities to put out, I have a 42-page list of Montessori activities on my website, which I'll definitely link to in the show notes. But the best activities are simply the ones that you set up once you've observed your child to see what they're interested in and what skills they're learning to master. So we can choose then like an activity that is a little bit challenging for them without being too difficult, because if it's too easy, then you often see them throw it. And also similarly, you'll see them throw toys that are too difficult as well. So you're looking for ones that are kind of challenging that they really need to work at, but not being too hard. Older children can, you know, select for themselves which ones they're enjoying the most, and younger children, you know, we do need to observe quite carefully to know which ones they're working to master and which ones are too hard or too easy and can be put away for now. So then we look at our space and see if there's anything that our child is always trying to get into that we don't want them to touch. Because basically we want to create a yes space. It's a space where we don't have to say no all the time. And we look at problem areas and find ways to remove them. So it might be as simple as storing some fragile things in another room for now where they're safe behind a closed door. We can even put things like iPads and TV remotes and things that we don't want our children to touch in a cupboard out of sight, you know, so you don't have that battle constantly. It's not the first thing they pick up when they walk into the room. And you could even look at maybe placing your furniture in a different way so your children can't access those tempting sockets or wires or things that we're worried about that they might damage. Then we won't constantly need to nag our children, and we can reserve no for those emergency moments. So when we also set up our space in a Montessori way, we're setting it up so that they can be independent. And when they're independent, they build their confidence and they, you know, learn to take responsibility around the house. So this could be everything from having things on trays and baskets so that they can manage them themselves more easily, to having a small broom, a mop, a dustpan, and cloths at the ready for them to tidy up any spills or mess, you know, things like that. And it doesn't have to become then a moment of stress, like if something spills, we could simply go, the glass spilled, let's go get a cloth. And we could also have their plates, bowls, and glasses in a low cupboard in the kitchen for them to get themselves. Or in the bedroom, you can also add independence by having a basket that they can reach with two choices of clothing, or closed down low, like in a low cupboard, so that they can choose themselves. And then instead of turning on a screen when we need to cook, we can also invite our children to help us. We can have a step ladder or just a low step or a learning tower so that they can reach the kitchen to help. Or we could even just bring everything to the dining room table and do it kind of more like an Italian style. Everyone's helping prepare the food. And they won't want to prepare food every day, but you can definitely make that an invitation and have our spaces set up so that they can be involved in those processes. So two last things then. I would add beauty to the space. So we can make it an inviting, cozy space by adding artwork down low at the child's height. So mostly we have our artwork up high, you know, for the adult's benefit. But I love having some low pictures at their height, and also some plants that, you know, I love having plants in the space because they really soften the space, and children can also learn to look after them. Also cozy spots with cushions and blankets and perhaps even some fairy lights or handmade bunting can make it look really attractive as well. So then lastly, look at your space then from your child's height. So I always say sit on the floor at the height of your child to see from their perspective. And like if it's a baby, you're going to be lying on the floor. And things are going to look different from down low. And we may see things like cords or power outlets that they need to be covered up so that they aren't so attractive for our child. And you might even just find that, you know, when we store things up high on top of cupboards and the bookshelves and things, it actually can feel quite overwhelming still to a child who's down low on the floor. So you can then keep adjusting your spaces until it feels just right. And then you'll be able to enjoy your fresh and inviting spaces and hopefully your calm children as well. So that should be more than enough to get you started setting up your home in a Montessori way, or perhaps making some adjustments if you've already, you know, started on this process. And if you do make any changes, I'd love to see them. So perhaps you could tag me on Instagram to show me. And if you need someone to hold your hand and walk you step by step and room by room through the process, I also have a 4-week self-study course on my website. So you might want to check that out as well. Okay, let's not wait any longer. Here is my conversation with Nicole from Radical Beginnings, and I'll be back after this to answer this week's listener question all about sharing. So Nicole is also a fellow toddler teacher, and you've been a toddler teacher for nearly 20 years, and right now you're working in a 0-3 class, what's the age of the kids and how many kids are there, and do you have an assistant, all that kind of thing?
So right now I'm working at a school here in the foothills of Colorado, and we serve children in my class. They can start as young as 12 months old, but we ask that they're walking well. And the way that I kind of define walking well is that you can walk and carry something at the same time, because our environment's not really set up for the younger children, unfortunately. So they're, you know, around 12 months. Typically I get them between like 15 months and 18 months is when they start.
And then they stay in the class till they're around three?
Till they're three. Yeah. With the way that licensing is set up in Colorado, I'm not capable of moving them up any earlier than three because of the chokeables law. So they don't want them to be in an environment with any chokeables. And obviously the primary or the children's house environment has lots of small objects. So they stay with me until they're three, which actually works out great. You know, I just kind of add extensions or modify some of the work to make sure that those three-year-olds are really engaged. And I've got 10 students currently and one assistant. And our environment right now is part-time. So the children are only there for 3 hours a day, which is quite lovely. They arrive at 8 and they leave at 11 and they do snack with me at school. We do a community snack, but they go home and eat lunch at home and nap at home, which I miss lunch. I miss a community lunch, but I also love that they nap at home because I find that children nap so much better when they're in their home environment compared to a community environment. Some, I guess. Every child's different, but I really love the hours. It works well for me because I can still do radical beginnings in the afternoons, and it's kind of the best of both worlds for me right now, which I love.
It's so nice because, yeah, you can do your consulting and your mentoring and all the Instagram inspiration that you provide everybody. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, I was just going to say, I love doing all of that. I have to share it somehow. So Instagram's been a great outlet to share some of my ideas and the things that go on in my head, especially when I spend my mornings with the children and come home and, you know, processing all the beautiful things that I saw during the morning and then want to share with more than just my 10 students and their families.
Yeah. And also how you work with your assistant as well. I love seeing posts about how you're, you know, training these people up as well.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I first started, it was, I started as an assistant actually. And my role was very much like I was in the bathroom or I was singing songs and I didn't really do a lot of hands-on work. I didn't know how to give lessons or anything like that. And as I've been in the environment with toddlers, you know, they don't know who's trained and who's not in the environment. And so I've really taken to training my assistant to be able to give lessons, to be able to show the children the language lessons or some of the longer practical life lessons because they're capable of it. They don't have to go to training to know how to give some of these lessons. And then we are both serving the children in such a beautiful way, which I love.
And the assistant is so valuable. Like even if they are changing and diapering, there's so much learning that goes on in that process. And if you can actually take the time to train them to do that in a Montessori way, then the child is benefiting even in a nappy changing situation.
Absolutely, 100%. And you know, I actually love the bathroom with the children. So I tend to do it almost more than my assistant does, which is kind of rare in a toddler environment. But like you said, there's so much learning that takes place in the bathroom environment, from language to gross motor work to learning how your body works. I think it's a really beautiful part of the process. And again, it's a lot easier when I only have the children for 3 hours a day compared to some toddler guides that are there for 8 hours a day. Then the bathroom feels a little different when you're there for that long, I think.
Well, I think it's useful to note that not many people know of the half-day program, but that is actually the ideal time for a child. So it's a very child-centered approach to actually have the 3 hours. Then they go home and they can still be with their, like you say, they can nap at home and they can have the afternoon free. So that's actually set up mostly for the toddler to benefit. And the other way around is when it benefits the parent, which is also fine. But it's just like they're then in a beautiful Montessori environment for the whole day, but it actually is set up more for the convenience of the adult, at least till 3 years old anyway.
Yes, absolutely. And I work in a community where the morning session really works for us. When I lived in the city, you know, the full day was really what parents needed. They needed the childcare aspect along with the school aspect. But it's been interesting and neat to live in the mountains and have a community that's a little bit different, more families that work from home, that are able to kind of make their schedule and be creative with it, which allows us to really follow the child, which is quite beautiful and such a privilege for all of us to be able to follow the child in that way. I know not everyone has that ability. And, you know, I always thought when I did work in full day classes, what a beautiful environment it was. You know, it's the second best place for the child to be outside of home.
Cool. So I actually really love to always start these conversations with a little, you know, insight into your childhood and perhaps something, you know, good or bad that has impacted the way that you then go and work with the children that you work with.
I love this question. And I grew up in Colorado, outside of Denver in the suburbs. And you know, my parents are wonderful. I adore them. But what really taught me and what I really use daily, and not only my professional life, but my personal life, is that my brother, my only sibling, who's about 5 years younger than me, was born with pretty severe disabilities, both cognitively and physically. So he basically stopped growing inside of my mom. It's called inner uterine growth retardation, where you kind of stop growing, and he was born real premature, and they kind of knew something was up, but they didn't know exactly. And then around 3 years old, it really started to manifest where he was having a really tough time moving his body, kind of in conflict with his body. And so after, my dad's a scientist, he's a rocket scientist. So my brother was born into the right family with a father that really wanted to figure all this out. They discovered that he has this neurological disorder called dystonia. And it's a lot like Parkinson's, where your muscles move in conflict with your body. So like if I tell my hand to reach out and grab a glass of water, my brother Michael's body tells it to go all different ways. So it presents himself as being really shaky. He has a hard time walking. And he actually had a few years ago a procedure called deep brain stimulation surgery, where they open up your brain while you're awake, which is wild to me, and put in electrodes that fire signals to help with his dystonia. And the beautiful part of it was it really helped with his upper body, but it made his lower body a lot more shaky. So he has a really hard time walking. And on top of that, he has also got some cognitive stuff. I think if he was born in this day and age, he probably would have been diagnosed with autism. But when he was born and when my parents were learning about this, autism wasn't as widely known as it is now. So he lives with my parents, and he'll eventually come and live with myself and my husband. And he's phenomenal. He's such a neat human being. And what it's given me is this understanding that we are all so different in how we learn. And so like Michael, for example, has taught himself how to read with CDs. He's keeping the CD industry alive because he won't download anything. It's so funny. I said, do you want an iPad so you can get all this music, you know, in one place? And the CDs, there's something about the tangible part of it, I think, that he really loves. But he's taught himself how to read, reading the like jackets inside of the CD cases. Or he's like really witty and funny, and you know, he's got these quirks that are so beautiful about him, but then in some regards, like he has a hard time feeding himself. Like someone's got to be there to prepare meals for him, or he has a hard time getting around. However, he can play golf like a pro. Like he goes up and swings a golf club, and it's amazing. So, you know, just my whole life, I've been kind of watching him. I've always been an observer. When I look back on, home videos of myself, I'm typically like in the corner watching everyone, which has served me really well in this career of mine. But watching Michael and watching him learn and watching him navigate this world has really served me well in my ability to work with toddlers. And I'm so grateful for that. It's such a blessing in disguise of this, and how I communicate with Michael is almost similar to how I communicate with toddlers and their families, and having this real sensitive side to me of families that, you know, if there are red flags coming up or if we are seeing things where we want to work on it, I feel like I have this advantage because I've not only seen my brother go through this, but I've watched my parents go through this also of having a child with some exceptionalities, I like to say. So, that's really, really impacted me in my life growing up and like I said, in my work that I do now in serving the child and family.
Yeah, beautiful. And actually, I did want to talk about, you know, this observation and what you see in the classroom, and I guess what I call Montessori moments. So we both work with toddlers, and we both think the toddlers are brilliant, which is not always a common, you know,
right,
thought about toddlers. Most people get very frustrated by toddlers and think they're very frustrating and that they throw inappropriate and ill-timed tantrums and all these things. But I want you to share maybe a couple of examples of the brilliant things that your toddlers do in the classroom so that people can get this other picture of the toddler.
Everything from the second they walk in. So one of the things that I really love about the toddlers in my class right now is that in the mornings, they know every single car of every single child. So it's like in the mornings, we have a big window so they can see children arriving, and they know the second that a car pulls up, oh, so-and-so is here. Oh, this child's here. And that, you know, ability at such a young age to like, they know my car, they know my assistant's car, they know if I drove my husband's car or if I've driven my car. It's really this like they're so perceptive to what's going on around them. And I love that piece. And then beyond that, you know, it's these moments in the environment where you look and they are working with something that maybe I've presented. So I've shown them how to do flower arranging, for example. And I'm giving them this lesson on pouring water into a funnel that goes into a vase, and then they collect the flowers. And what I love about them is that then they take it and do it their own way. Rarely do I give a lesson and the child does it the exact way that I've shown it. I don't want them to do it exactly how I did it, and I want them to be a part of the learning process. I have a philosophy that, you know, if you show a child something and they do it right and perfect the first time, then it was shown too late. I think that there's something really beautiful about children working and learning and figuring it out, because you learn so much by doing. And so watching children figure out, you know, does the stem go in first? Does the flower go in first? And having that hands-on experience of trying to stick the flower into the vase and learning on their own that that doesn't work, it doesn't fit, and flipping it around and putting the stem in first to the vase, and doing all of that without my input, you know, of this real hands-on control of error work of the mind is some of my favorite things to see in the class, you know. And that takes a lot of restraint on the adult's part to stand back and let them kind of struggle and figure it out. And most of the time they figure it out. And if they need help, most of the time they'll ask, which is another beautiful part of being with toddlers, is that they learn by that doing and by repeating and figuring it out on their own. And I just think that is so beautiful and such a gift for them for later in life too, when they're learning other skills and life gets harder, because that's just the way that life goes, you know? So giving them this confidence to keep trying and being okay with failure and all of that are some of my favorite aspects in the class. And flower arranging flowers with young children is my most favorite thing to do with them. I think it is so lovely. You know, Maria Montessori tells us that the child deserves to live in an environment of beauty, and that arranging flowers is such a beautiful, it's putting her words to life, I think, of adding beauty to the environment while also observing the children doing such work of the mind at the same time.
Yeah, and there's so much sequencing involved with the whole process as well. So they're learning a lot, and there's the fine motor control of like carrying water very carefully and pouring into funnel, and then the sponge because everything will spill. And so there's so many aspects. It's not just beauty, is it? They're learning so much and becoming so capable.
What's beautiful about the Montessori environment, and I've only worked with toddlers, so I can really only speak to that, but there's something more to everything. So yes, flower arranging adds beauty, but it's also adding sequencing and activating the mathematical mind and learning control of error and how to walk slowly and all of that. And that's everything that is within these prepared environments for Montessori is like that, you know, even to putting on shoes or taking off socks or learning how to communicate or learning how to ask for a hug. That's one of my favorite things to help the children understand in class, is this idea of consent and asking for hugs or asking to touch someone else or asking to hold hands or whatever it is, you know, learning this part of the process. There's so much more to that than just, there's just so much more to it. I love that piece of Montessori.
Yeah, I think that last point is also something that to really highlight, because I think to some parents that's quite a new idea. Like, what do you mean I need to ask consent from my child if I want to pick them up? But it can start from the time they're a baby, when you're saying, I'm going to pick you up now. And you just wait for that moment where they raise their arms to kind of give their consent. And then like, rather than saying, give me a hug, it'd be like, would you like a hug? Or is it okay that I have a hug? You know, that kind of thing. So to actually ask them first, and then they're learning that consent from such a young age.
Absolutely. And it starts out with, and I think you're right, parents get a little bit confused by this at first. And it really starts out by telling the child what you're going to do, right? When they're in the infancy, age, and then moving that and progressing that to asking them for permission. And I think that it's so important to respect the child's space and their body. They're the owner of their body, and they really get say in what and who they want to hug and give affection to. And, you know, when I have parents in my class that'll say, give Nicole a hug, I'll immediately say, would you like a hug or maybe a high five? So that I'm kind of giving them an option to do what they'd like. And if they tell me no, that's fine too. You know, toddlers are, they keep me very humble. I was joking with some parents recently about how, you know, if they don't want to hug you, they'll walk away. If they're not into what you're showing them, they will walk away. Like, and it's got nothing to do with you. It's just they're following their own little inner guide inside. And there's no, I don't get upset, or I don't say, you have to come back here and do this. I just say, oh, okay, well, maybe we'll try again tomorrow.
Yeah. And even it's when they arrive in the classroom, isn't it? Like sometimes they don't want to say hello in like that. They want to shake hands immediately and they want to maybe show you something on their t-shirt, or they can tell you about something they found, or, you know, you can find other ways for them to greet you, or, you know, you don't have to force, come on, you have to say hello right now.
Exactly. And I do a lot of, the parents in my class walk their children in. We have kind of a little entrance area, and they come in and they change into inside shoes because we live in the mountains. And I don't want them tracking mud and dirt and snow and everything into the environment, because we do so much work on the floor in the class. And two, because it adds this extra element of practicing taking off shoes and putting them on, which I think is really lovely. And I wear inside shoes. My assistant wears inside shoes. It's kind of, it reminds me of Mr. Rogers a little bit, where he changed his sweater and then he was like in it. I feel that way when I put on my inside shoes. Like, I'm like, all right, now I'm Nicole the toddler guide. But parents get to kind of come into this this area. And a lot of times they'll say, you know, do you want to tell Nicole what we saw on the way to school? And the child will hide behind their parents. And what I always say is, do you want to tell me, or do you want your dad to tell me? And that kind of gives them, again, this say in what they want to do and how they feel. And I think it's a real act of respect for them, too, because they're not, you know, it's hard when someone puts you on the spot if you're not ready for it. And a lot of times the parent will say, oh, we saw elk. And then I can really engage the child in a conversation from them there. You got to see the elk this morning? Oh, my goodness. You know, and it opens this up for us, rather than me just sitting there staring at them going, what are you going to tell me? Because they don't want to tell me. They need someone's help to tell them.
Yeah. And I also think that, I mean, it's not our fault when we all well-meaning when we do these things, because we think that it's important that they learn to greet the teacher. So don't, if we're talking about something that you've done, please don't feel ashamed. And in fact, like the other one that I think comes up a lot is like, I'm leaving without you, because we wanted leave and we are kind of basically giving them an ultimatum, except I know I've actually been on the end of that as a child and feeling completely like distraught that my mother or my father would actually leave me. So I remember reading that you did a post, I think, about that as well.
Yes, that's a big one for me. And I love, there's a quote I read somewhere. It was like, and I'm sure you've heard it. It's like, I forgive myself for not knowing what I didn't know then, or something about, you know, kind of if you're a parent listening to this right now and you've done some of these things, no worries. There's always time to make a shift and learn and understand how kind of your child's brain's working and to shift course a little bit. And that statement of I'm leaving without you, it works maybe once or twice. And then the child quickly learns that you're not going to leave without them, one. And also it can be really scary for some children to actually think that their parent is going to leave them. So, you know, my philosophy on that is, you know, you both scare and lie to your child all in one quick sentence, which I know parents are not meaning to do. They're just trying to get their child to leave wherever you're trying to leave. So I've heard it all throughout my career. I've even used it before, a long time ago, not for a long time, but I know that I was guilty of it too, because it does have effects pretty quickly. But like I said, it loses its luster there pretty fast.
Yeah. And what do you offer instead then?
So instead, what I offer parents, and this is what I offer for most aspects, is providing choices. So it's time to go. And I really like warnings too for children. So like when it's almost time to go home at school, I start to give them a heads up. Oh, the day's almost over. you know, so that they're, it's not just this abrupt change in their routine. I don't give like a 5-minute warning because young children don't really understand that concept of 5 minutes or 1 minute or just a moment. That's not quite in their brain power yet. So I'll just say soon. Your mom or your dad or your nanny or whoever is coming soon. If they don't want to leave, I have some children that, you know, would, we, our children get picked up on the playground and they don't want to leave. And so I give them choices. Do you want to hold my hand or do you want to walk to your mom all by yourself? And then for parents, it's time to go. Do you want to walk by yourself or do I need to carry you? And the beautiful thing about young children, and this, these choices really only work under the age of 3. After 3, the choices, that then there becomes a third choice. And with toddlers, you can do the 2 choices for a while and then they stop working. But when they do work, they're beautiful. And it really empowers this child that wants to be independent and wants to make their own choices. But we limit it by 2. So, you know, do you want to walk to the car? Or do you want to run to the car? You know, and making it kind of this exciting thing instead of this like forced, I'm annoyed thing. Even though sometimes it can be annoying. And sometimes what I tell parents is sometimes you've got to carry a screaming child to the car and that's okay. It's time to go. This is the limit. I do have one parent who has a really hard time getting her child to leave school. And so she sets a timer on her watch. So when the timer dings, it's time to go. And she sets it based on the weather pretty much. As if it's a beautiful day, sometimes it'll be a few minutes. If it's really cold outside, it'll be 30 seconds. But again, when she hears that ding, it's time to leave. And it's this auditory thing that her child can hear and understands, okay, now it's time to go. And that's really been helpful for her also. So it's getting creative. And I know that's hard when you're in the like thick of it and you're in this moment of like, we need to go. They're not listening. And again, that's sometimes when you have to give them the choice. And again, it's part of consent. You can walk or I'm going to carry you. And if they don't make the choice, then I guess I'm going to have to make the choice for you. And I'm going to carry you today and we can try again tomorrow. And that seems to work really well with the young child, especially if you're consistent in it. The first couple times you might be carrying a screaming child and then they start to understand, okay, mom or dad or my caregiver, whoever the adult is that's saying this isn't joking around. They mean business. And I need to either walk or be carried.
Yeah, actually, I think that's perfect because I wanted to talk to you about setting boundaries in a respectful way. I mean, you know, people say toddlers and children in general can just be so defiant and like they're not trying to do it on purpose to wind you up and like their behavior is communication.
Right, right. And it's so hard with young children because it feels like they're doing it on purpose, especially if they're tapping into something that bothers us, you know, if there's something inside of us that, you know, it feels like they can do it on purpose and they're really not. I think that is the piece of information that has allowed me to work with toddlers for this long and stay sane is that I fully understand that they are not doing things on purpose to upset me. Anything they're doing is really in the spirit of their own self-construction.
What does that mean to someone? Self-construction is a complicated term that Montessori people like to say.
So it's really just kind of figuring out who they are and what they need. So I like to say that, you know, young children know exactly what they need. And if we can line up what we need them to do with what they already want to do, then it's a match made in heaven. But that's really, really challenging. It takes some problem solving and it takes some observing them and really knowing the child. And it's great because parents know their children. You know your child as a parent better than anyone else. And I think teachers sometimes forget this. but the parent knows their child better than anyone else. So you really know kind of what they need. And the way that I kind of look at this aspect of the child is that, one, again, to reiterate, they're not doing things on purpose. That happens later. I think it happens around like 4 years old when they kind of start to purposefully push your buttons. But up until then, they're really just little scientists trying to find out what's acceptable and what's not acceptable within the society or community that they live within. And I think when we look at it that way, it's really beautiful that their testing of limits isn't to test our limits and see how far they can push us. It's to test the limits of the world because here's this 2-year-old or 2.5-year-old or 15-month-old that's in this great, big, huge world. And what they're really craving is for us to define and to give some boundaries for them, even though it might not seem like it sometimes, and even though they're going to push against those limits sometimes. So the way that I explain it to folks is that, you know, the limits that we set up. So a limit being like, you know, inside, we're going to keep our feet on the floor. Outside, you can climb. Or I love inside, we speak in a quieter voice. Outside, you can scream and shout. And I live in the mountains where this you can do that really easily without disturbing neighbors. Or another limit might be, you know, you are free to walk on the sidewalk, but when we cross the street, we hold hands. You know, those are all some limits and boundaries that the child has. We chew food. People, we don't bite them. You know, those are all sorts of limits that we have. And what these create, and I use the metaphor of driving over a bridge. So if you're driving over a bridge, you know, crossing a river and driving over a bridge and there are no guardrails, you're going to drive pretty slowly. And not only that, you're not really going to pay attention to the beauty of the world around you because you're going to be focused on getting across this bridge safely and not going over the edge that has no limits. Whereas if you put up some boundaries, you can drive across this bridge much more safely, with much more confidence. And along the way, you can also notice the beauty around you because you've got some boundaries and you feel secure. And then on the flip side, if you build too big of boundaries, then you've blocked out all the beauty of the world. So we really need to establish these like fair and just and kind of not huge boundaries, but limits so that the child can navigate the world and really move forward in a way where they feel confident and secure, but can still explore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's such a beautiful metaphor. And I think it would be really fun to now like use all your experience from being in the classroom so that parents can like, okay, let's apply that then to like a picky eater or a child who doesn't stop eating. So how do you give some guardrails, but not be so kind of protective on one side, too many, you know, too high a guardrail, but have no boundary at all. And then it feels unsafe.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, especially in regards to food, because that you know, food and sleep and using the bathroom tend to be kind of the three big power struggle areas for adults with young children. And so when it comes to food, I love my Montessori trainer, and I think we have the same trainer. You trained with Judy O'Ryan,
exactly.
Correct?
Yeah.
She used to say, no child in the history of the world has starved themselves on purpose. They will eat, provided we give them healthy choices. And so that's kind of rung, you know, stayed in my mind as this, like, you know, we can create boundaries and not worry about a child starving to death, because they're not going to if we're setting up the environment for success. And what I mean for success with that is, you know, if you have a picky eater, I like to think of a couple things with that. One, children's taste buds are different than the adult's taste buds. So what tastes good to me might not taste good to the child, genuinely. And I think we forget that sometimes and just chalk them off as a picky eater and, oh, they just want macaroni and cheese. And, you know, broccoli can be really bitter for a young child. So they genuinely might not enjoy it, which is okay. And what I tell parents or caregivers of picky eaters is just keep trying. Give them something they like and give them something that they to try. And if they don't try it, that's no big deal. Eat with them, you know. So if you're putting out, let's see, right now it's spring in Colorado, so asparagus is really widely available. So if you're putting out asparagus, eat it with them. And not only eat it with them, but maybe prepare it with them and invite the child to serve themselves so that it's not just all of a sudden this weird foreign green stick on their plate that they have no relationship with. They have touched it and felt it and watched it cook and transform and been able to serve themselves. And that really opens them up, I think, to eating while still creating some boundaries of, I'm not going to just give you macaroni and cheese every night. Yes, there'll be a little bit of macaroni and cheese on the plate, but there's also going to be some asparagus and maybe something, you know, something else on the plate so that we're not just catering to their needs. I think Judy O'Ryan also said, you're not a short order cook. Was one of her quotes too. So, you know, I'm a big advocate of eating what the family eats. And the other thing that I really like to remind adults is that portion sizes for toddlers are very small. And we tend to put a lot of food on their plate and expect them to eat it all. And that's not the case for their tiny little stomachs. So dialing down the size of what's on their plate, because they can always ask for more. You know, so I also love like family style dining. So having some bowls on the table where the child can serve themselves is also beneficial to helping that picky eater. And some children just go through a phase where all they want is peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And that's okay, because toddlers also thrive on order. And so if they're eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every single day, and then all of a sudden they don't want peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, that's okay. That's just kind of the way their brain works. And you just move on to something new. It's our job to provide healthy choices. And again, not be a short order cook. So you're not like, do you want this or this or this or this or this? And I'll make you this. And I just want you to eat. It's more, this is what we're having for dinner. And here's what's on your plate. And enjoy. And I'm going to be eating right here next to you. Because a lot of children also get plopped down to eat by themselves, with no company and no one around. And I think there's something really beautiful about eating together, if possible. I know that's not the case for everyone. I had one family who the parents worked late. They just could not eat like a family dinner together. So instead they ate breakfast together every morning, and that was their community meal. And I think that's really lovely too. So you're not just sitting alone eating for every meal, because that's not fun either. I mean, I like eating by myself sometimes, but I also really enjoy company too, and having it be a lovely experience.
Yeah. And they're going to pick that up from, you know, how you model eating, and that, you know, mealtime is also about communication and company and all those kind of things. And have you ever had a child in your class who doesn't stop eating? So for example, they are serving themselves, you know, too many times and not taking care of their friends. What would you say then?
Yes, definitely have those children in class. And like, depending on what we have too for snack, like if we have like berries, there's always one child that wants to take the whole bowl and eat them all. So in a community setting, it's really easy. I mean, the language that I use there is, hey, everyone needs some. So when everyone's had their fill and everyone served themselves, then you can take some more. But we're going to make sure that everyone gets some berries first. The other thing is, again, and I think this works well for families too, is putting limits on things. So I suggest having, if you can, and if you have the space for it, having a small cupboard, one that your child can access, that has some snacks in it that you've pre-prepared and put in there. So like a little jar with some cereal, maybe some applesauce, you know, things that are kind of shelf stable. And your child, if they're hungry, can go and get it. And when it's gone, it's gone. And it gets replenished the next day. And it puts this limit on it. Oh, I noticed you've enjoyed all the cereal already today. I'll put some more in there tomorrow. So that the child's able to get what they need and kind of follow their hunger, while also not overindulging on things and then not being hungry later for dinner or whatnot. But I also know that toddlers don't tend to overindulge, really. They pretty much eat when they're hungry. So if a child's eating a lot, that's kind of my note of like, maybe there's a growth spurt going on, or maybe they didn't eat very much breakfast this morning. So I'm going to kind of watch and see what you're doing and, you know, put a limit on it if it comes to a point where no one else is going to be able to enjoy it. Like we have banana slicing out for the children every day, and I put out a specific number of bananas based on what we have for the week. And there are some children that would peel, cut, and enjoy like all the bananas. And part of that is they love the whole process of being able to peel it and cut it themselves. And then they just shove it all in their mouth and they're walking back to the shelf with a full mouth of banana to get another one. And it's really lovely. I mean, it kind of makes me, it's heartwarming. But it's also a situation too where I may say, hey, you know, someone else might want to slice bananas. Let's take a little bit of a break. And as my dad always says, sometimes when you're hungry, you're really just thirsty. So I really push water a lot with children. I think most young children don't get enough water throughout the day. I also live at a really high altitude. We're really high up in the mountains, so it's important that everyone's drinking water where we are. But I think that we forget to offer children water throughout the day too. And sometimes we can feel hungry, but actually we're just thirsty for water. So that's another kind of limit that you can put on it too. Okay, we're done with the bananas. Let's go enjoy some water. Do you want to drink it out of your water bottle or do you want a cup of water? And that kind of changes the child's focus.
Yeah. I love how kindly and clearly you set the limit. You're not getting angry at them, but it's just very clear. It's like, it's just not an option. And I'm curious then, like if you have a child who hits another child or bites or throws, I guess you'd probably have a similar way to keep everyone safe, but also show the child that that's not okay and how they can make it up to their friend.
Absolutely. And that's another really big, you know, I think hot topic with parents, with caregivers, with really all adults that serve young children is what happens when they hit. What happens when they bite? What happens when they scratch or take someone, you know, take a toy or whatever it is, because it happens. And, you know, the language that I use in this, and it took me a while to get to this point, because initially you really want to go towards the child that has, we'll say hitting, for example, we'll use that. You really want to go to the child that has hit. And what I've learned over the years is instead, my initial reaction, I go to the child that's been hit. Oh, I see you got hit. Did that hurt? Was it scary? And then we together will look at the child that hit. I didn't like that, you know, or some kind of language, but I'm trying to not give attention to the child that hit. The other part that I really find important is that I don't force the child to say sorry. I think that it loses a lot of meaning when we're saying to a child, say sorry. You hit him, say sorry, because they're not really understanding what sorry means if we're just telling them to say it. So what I do in that situation is I say, well, if I hit someone, I would definitely tell them I'm sorry. I might ask if they need a hug or, you know, in the case of biting, I'll say, you know, oh, I wonder if they need some ice. Do you think they need some ice for that bite? That must have hurt. So that I'm really kind of empathizing with both parties. Because toddlers don't hit or bite or push or take toys to hurt the other child. They're doing it mostly as an act of communication or testing a limit. So if I hit someone, what happens? You know, that's how children figure out, because they can't verbally say if I hit someone, what happens. So they hit and then they wait for our response. And if they hit someone and we're giving them all the attention, then it's like, oh, well, if I hit someone, Nicole comes and hangs out with me. But if I'm giving my attention to the other child, that kind of changes the game a little bit. And it's like, oh, I hit and I didn't really get anything from that and nothing changed. And that's what I want the child to learn is, one, hitting's not going to get you what you want. And two, after you hit someone, there are some things that you need to do in order to kind of make it right, I guess, or help. After that. So it sounds so counterintuitive, but it really helps if we give the attention initially to the child that has been hit or has been bit.
Yeah. Gives them a moment to calm down and, you know, they're seeing, watching and observing how you're interacting with the person who's been hit. And then they might be ready to actually make it up to their friend.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of times, you know, the beautiful thing about toddlers too, is they tend not to hold a grudge. So you'll see them like hit each other or hit, and then they are back to playing and like nothing happened in a couple moments later, you know. And it depends on the severity, and it depends on if it's happening a lot. Like I had a child in my class once who was biting the same child over and over and over again, and nothing I did helped. And we finally had to separate the children into different classrooms because it was just compulsive. And I still, to this day, it baffles me. So there are all different levels of this, right? Like there are like the minor incidences and then there are the bigger ones. And, you know, after 20 years of working with toddlers, they still sometimes baffle me. I don't have them completely down. You know, they still confuse me sometimes. But I think it's really important that we model empathy, you know. And the other piece is that, like, you know, if I bump into my assistant or if I bump into the children, I'm really tall. I'm 5'10" and I work with all these tiny humans and I knock them over sometimes, you know, like I'll turn around and they'll be right at my ankles and I didn't realize it. And I'm I know.
And I'm laughing because it happens to me all the time and I feel like the clumsiest person. I'm like, I'm a Montessori teacher. Exactly. I shouldn't be bumping into my students.
And I feel so terrible because you can see that they're just like, what? but I'm really dramatic and very, like, I almost want the whole class to hear. I'm so sorry I knocked you over. Let me help you up. Do you need a hug? Like, so that I'm really modeling when I invade someone's space or when I, you know, knock someone over, they're seeing how I respond to it. Or if I bump into my assistant on accident, oh, I'm so sorry, excuse me. Or, you know, whatever I can do to model that behavior too. I've even told parents, you know, at home to like act it out, you know, like to have mom and dad, you know, like bonk into each other and then in front of the child. So you can kind of model what you do in that situation. And that's, I think, a beautiful way for the children to learn and kind of understand and start to develop that empathy.
Yeah, it's so true. Like as a, particularly with young children, but all children, you know, we are modeling the behavior. So what we say is one thing, but what we do is another. So like even just the saying please and thank you, rather than saying, what do you say? What do you say? If we're constantly saying, please, thank you, you're welcome, then they're picking up that example. And there's so many times when I think of us as toddler teachers as this model of how we want the kids to behave in the class.
Absolutely. I like to joke that I say please too often. Like I'll say like, please push in your chair, please. I don't laugh at myself because I know how important it is, you know, that they're listening to my language and really, really gaining their language and communication from us. That's how they learn to communicate, is by listening and watching us. And so being really intentional about the words that we use with the child is so important. And it's beautiful to watch them pick up on it naturally without being told to say please or thank you or you're welcome or hello and goodbye. All of those things really come naturally to them if we're saying them ourselves.
Yeah. And I think particularly because we work with children under three, we are, you know, trusting that the unconscious absorbent mind is picking these things up. And then over three, you can do the grace and courtesy lessons, like what do we say when we receive a gift, and you can practice in advance of a birthday and those kind of things.
Exactly. And I love the, you know, this, the differentiation between the two, you know, of understanding that under three, we're really not telling the child what to do. We're just, you know, preparing an environment that's safe and engaging for them to do within. And they learn naturally and without effort. And I think that's one of those magical pieces of toddlers too, is watching as they absorb all this information around them. And then having that ability to then expand on it after three and be able to really talk about it at that point. And why do we do these things? And yeah, I just think that it's, again, that building on that comes from Montessori, where, you know, us toddler guides are really laying this foundation for the child as they grow older. And I have to remind myself that a lot of times the things that we do in the toddler environment, we never see actually manifest. We never see it come to fruition. It comes about later in their life. And it's our role to really trust that we're giving them what they need. And knowing that we may never see that change. And that's one of the hardest parts of being a toddler guide, is that we sometimes never see the work that we do come to fruition. And it is a lot of trust.
Definitely. I also remember reading that you said, like, in terms of modeling behavior, that we should also model being polite and warm, speaking clearly, and being conscious of the energy that we are using when we're communicating. And I thought that was so specific, but actually really helpful, because you can say the right words but have the wrong energy behind it. And toddlers particularly will pick it up, but any child senses it immediately, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I almost think that adults sense it too, right? But children really sense the way that we're communicating. And so I remember when my husband and I first met, and he's like, why do children love you so much? You know, it's because, one, the first thing that I do when I meet a new child specifically, but really for all children, is I get down on their level so that I can look them in the eyes. And I have this philosophy that, you know, toddlers, a lot of times parents think, my toddler always wants to be held. They want to be in my arms all the time. And it's not because they don't want to walk. And it's not because they're lazy. It's because they want to look into your face. And that's how they're learning how to communicate. And that's how they're really, that's how they're learning how to communicate. So I get down on their level so that immediately I'm showing them this sign of respect. And there's a beautiful picture of, I think it was Prince William with his first son, when he first started at a Montessori school. And there's this picture of him down on, you know, squatting down and looking him in the eyes after his first day of school. And I thought, oh, that's just the poster for what I want parents to be doing with their child, whether they're down on their level or they're picking them up. Being able to look them in the eye, I think, is this first act of respect for them. But also, the way that we say things to children, I think this foundation of respect is so important, that we're speaking to them with a respectful tone. We're speaking to them also with kind of joy and enthusiasm. I know Montessori talked about, you know, I think the translation from Italian to English is a little bit off, because in English it's translated to we kind of seduce the child into work and into learning. And you know, to me, it's like this idea that we use this voice of like, I get to show you the dressing frames today, you know, and it's this like really kind of passionate, excited voice. And the children just latch onto that. They love it when we speak to them, rather than today we're going to look at the dressing frame. You know, there's like this, we really want to like, and the dressing frame, if you don't know, is how children in a Montessori toddler environment learn how to button or do zippers. It's in front of them. They first learn how to button on kind of a frame built in front of them, so that then they can do it on their body. But yeah, there's this voice that I kind of have when I'm with the toddlers that really engages them, and really like I love being able to get excited about things with them. When I first started teaching, I'll never forget going on a walk in the fall with the students, and one of my older, very verbal children said, "Do you hear that?" And so we all stopped and listened, and it was the leaves rustling along the street in fall. And it was this beautiful moment that stuck with me my whole career of, when we work with toddlers, we get to experience all these little things that we've forgotten about as adults alongside with them. So this beautiful sound of the leaves rustling along the ground, I couldn't remember the last time I stopped and really listened to that sound and the music it makes. And we get to do that in so many aspects with young children, which I think is beautiful. And if our language and our voice and our energy kind of matches that sense of wonder and excitement, it really draws the children into us and to want to learn together and be collaborative and have like just real positive moments, you know, instead of this idea of the terrible twos, it turns it into the terrific twos, where we're really honoring and enjoying the beauty of this time, because it goes by so fast too.
Yeah. I think though what they're picking up with this excitement in your voice is that you respect them, that you're really paying attention to them and you're really listening to them. And I think we sometimes don't give our full attention to a toddler, and they can just sense it in their heart. I think they pick that up. And I also really love the way that you're always really respectful in terms of the pronouns that you use, you know, giving children indication that they might be he, they might be she, or they might be they. Even at such a young age, you're already laying a foundation for them to learn from.
Yeah, it's been kind of fun to play around with. This is sort of new for me to do either. Once it kind of got, my attention was drawn to this idea that a lot of things we call he. Right. So it's like, even when we're reading a book about farm animals, it's like the cow, you know, he is eating grass. And I really try to jump around and use he, she, and they through all of the language that I have with the children. And I try to use they when I don't know the whatever character or person. If I don't know, I try to use they. And I think that's beautiful language for the children to begin to understand. I also, instead of using pronouns, will say the child when I'm reading stories, if it doesn't specifically say. You know, if it specifically says in the book and it's a book about a little girl, then I'm going to read it as she, most likely. But if it's a book where, you know, there are pictures of children and I don't know, then I love calling them children. It's the same thing with, I stop saying boys and girls to get their attention. I will say children or toddlers or hey everyone, or you know, I kind of try to take away that only two option boy or girl, and really give them the language that I think we need for the future of society, to think that, you know, there are people that identify differently than that. And it's not my position to decide one way or the other, or assume one way or the other.
And even it goes as far as like anti-bias and anti-racist education. From such a young age, we can already start that foundation as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of people ask, you know, well, how do you do anti-bias or anti-racist work with young children? And it's really very simple, which is lovely, because when the child gets older, it becomes way more complicated, and it has to do with a lot of unlearning. But with the young child, they're coming to us already anti-racist and anti-bias. So it's kind of our role not to establish or put into their mind things that progress them towards being racist or biased later in life. So it's making sure that, and what I do in my class, because I live in a very, I live in a community that everyone's pretty much the same and looks the same. So it's up to me and my environment to make sure that the books that I have and the language cards and what they see visually within the class represents all walks of life and represents all walks of life in all different situations. So that I don't have, you know, my only books aren't like, you know, Black folks playing basketball, right? That would feed into a stereotype. I want books that show all walks of life and all abilities too. There's a beautiful book it's the song If You're Happy and You Know It, but it's the words are a little bit different in this book, and they've got pictures of you know, child in a wheelchair, and they've got a picture of a child in a hijab, and they've got all different it's such a beautiful book because it represents all walks of life in a really beautiful way. And it's really as simple as that with young children. It's not about having these long, lengthy conversations. It's just making sure that we're giving them this idea that everyone is capable of doing anything.
Yeah. Actually, we'll have to look up the name of the book and put it in the show notes, because I'm sure people would love to look for that one particularly.
I will. It's a really beautiful book. And it's one of those lovely books where you can either sing it or read it. I love books that, you know, are based off of a song, and having the child be able to hear the spoken word and then also being able to sing it with them. So I'll be sure to send you the author of that book so that folks can add that to their library collection.
Thank you. And I also think that it extends to sex positivity and like naming body parts in a correct way. And, you know, if a child touches themselves, treating them in a respectful way, like where it's appropriate to touch yourself and, you know, like, okay, it looks like you have your hand down your pants. And, you know, I know you get that kind of behavior in your classroom all the time.
I do. And children, you know, I like to say that, you know, children in this age, you know, 3 and under, are really in this what phase. They want to know what things are. They want to have the name of everything. And that comes down to their body parts and other people's body parts. And, you know, when it comes to using the bathroom in a toddler environment, it's a community endeavor. There's not a lot of shame. There's not a lot of privacy. I call them our bathroom parties, when everyone ends up in the bathroom at the same time with no pants on, and they're all joyful and waiting to sit on the toilet. And it's wonderful. It's such a beautiful time for them to be able to learn in a very safe, safe way what your body parts are, what they're called, and for the adult to be able to speak them with confidence. So just as easily as I can say elbow, I can also say penis. You know, and that's really important for parents to understand. For one, body positivity. If we don't know the names of our body parts, that puts us at a disadvantage for understanding how our body works. So we really need to have the proper names for our body parts. You know, even down to if you're a pregnant mom, instead of saying the baby's in my belly, telling your child the baby is in my uterus. How confusing it must be for young children to think for a while that a baby's in your stomach. You know, I mean, why not give them? There's no shame in saying uterus. So I think using really correct terminology is so important there. But the other aspect of that, beyond that, and just being respectful for the children, because they are so curious. And when we don't answer their questions with truth and honesty, I think that's an act of disrespect. Even if they don't know it at the time, I still think they need real concrete information for us. That's what they're craving. The other big piece of labeling our body parts with correct terminology is that it helps keep your child safe from any kind of sexual violation or abuse. There's a woman here in Colorado that does trainings. It's called Parenting Safe Children. And this is information that I learned from her that just made sense when she said it, is that, you know, if you have like a nickname for your child's vulva and you're calling it a cookie, and your child comes to me and says, my uncle touched my cookie. Well, I might say, oh, well, you know, sharing's nice. Did you give him some? And how awful is that for a young child to be coming to me wondering if this is okay? And I've basically reinforced the behavior. Whereas if a young child comes to me and says, my uncle touched my vulva, that's a big red flag for me. How can I help, you know, support them in this? And so having these proper terms for your child's body parts are really important in keeping your child safe. And that feels so important to me too. My uncle is a pediatrician, and he, you know, we used to joke about all the different names that he's heard for body parts. And when he first would tell me about it, I would laugh and laugh. And then when he started telling me about it, it was like, ah, it's just kind of sad. We just really need to get comfortable as a society to say all the names of the body parts. And when we do, it becomes really easy. And it becomes, you know, the children in class will say, oh, so-and-so has a penis. Yes, they do. Oh, so-and-so has a vulva. Yes, they do. I have nipples. You know, they go through this whole thing. And all I say, yes, you do. You know, there's not, I don't have to go into a long description of it. We're not talking about sex. There's nothing sexual about it. It's just really concrete information for them. Just like they say, I have eyes. Yes, you do. I have eyes too. You know, so we can have those conversations in such a lovely, simple way that don't have to be uncomfortable, especially if we practice it.
Oh, this is great. And I guess I also want to ask you about the things that you do to look after yourselves, because working with toddlers is a lot of work. And I think the preparation of the adult, I talk about it probably in every episode, but I really yes. love to get people's wisdom. I mean, I think also I once read how important you said it was to let go of the day before, because sometimes mm-hmm. we carry some baggage and the toddler has well forgotten it. So yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on adult preparation and, you know, preparing yourself for a day.
Yeah. And this has really transformed over the years for me and looks so different now from what it did when I first started teaching. I had a really hard time letting things go. And I found myself sometimes holding grudges and feeling, I think what happened a lot was I let my ego get in the way a lot too. Like if we didn't have a perfect day, I would kind of beat myself up about it, which is so silly because there is no perfect day with toddlers, or every day is perfect with toddlers. You could look at it that way too. So it's really letting go of the day, you know, and self-reflecting too. Oh, you know, in that situation, I didn't really feel good about how I reacted. How might I be able to do that in a different way that feels more positive tomorrow, right? So I'm not forgetting or sweeping under the rug what happened. I'm just not letting it impact me the way that I did when I was a real young teacher. And I think that's something really important for both parents, because I've been doing this for 20 years. You only have a very short period of time to really understand your child, and then they've moved on to new development. I kind of joke that I'm like in Groundhog Day, where I'm just like perpetually with toddlers. So I get all this time to really learn best practices. But yeah, really letting go of the day before feels so important. And again, at my core, understanding that the children are not doing this to upset me, that this is who they are, and it is my role to guide them. And that's what I often call myself, a Montessori guide or a toddler guide, as opposed to a toddler teacher, because I'm really guiding the children. I don't feel like I'm teaching them. Yes, maybe, you know, in some regards, but it feels more like a guide. And when I took that label of teacher away and really took guide into my being, and understanding that parents are guides, any adult, other children are guides, like we all kind of serve as this model for the young child, and understanding that took a little pressure off. And it was like, okay, so I'm a guide, and some days I am going to be absolutely beautiful and my best self, and some days I'm not my best self, and that's okay. You know, and even letting the children know, oh, today I'm feeling a little sleepy. I didn't sleep great last night. And that sometimes makes me grumpy. You know, and being able to have those conversations with the children in a way where, like, I'm not always, hi, I'm here, I'm Nicole, and I'm joyful, and everything's sunshine and rainbows, because that's not how it is. is really beautiful too, to model for the children. So allowing myself to be human with them has been great. But on top of that, outside of the environment, so one of my most favorite quotes from Montessori, she says, it's not enough for the teacher to love the child. She must first love and understand the universe. She must prepare herself and truly work at it. And I love that quote because Maria wanted us, I like to call her Maria sometimes, like we're buddies. but she really wanted us to look beyond the child and to observe and love the universe and the world around us. So having this like deep love for the changing of the seasons, like right now the aspen trees where I live are starting to bud and the leaves are going to start sprouting out soon. And like that brings me so much joy to watch those things and to really love and appreciate the world around us. And I'm blessed to live in such a beautiful place where I can do that easily. But I think even in urban areas, you can do that also. I'm sure like in Amsterdam with the flowers that start blooming and, you know, really loving those moments. Last night I couldn't sleep and I was getting really frustrated. And so I was like, I'm just going to look out the window for a little while and watch the stars for a few minutes. And that calmed me down. So it's so much about loving the child, but it's so much about loving and observing the world around also. So that has really helped me in my practice and in my work, because I think we learn so much too from just observing what's around us and appreciating it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. And I think sometimes parents and teachers, we show up the best when we remember to be joyful about the world around us, when we bring that love and curiosity to the child, you know, let's look, let's find out together. And they pick that up, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely do. One of my favorite things to do with young children, and I don't know if you can do, I don't know if this company works outside of the States, but it's called Insect Lore. And you can get caterpillars that they mail you and you get to watch the process of metamorphosis. So you get to watch the caterpillars spin into a chrysalis and then open up into butterflies. And then you feed the butterflies for a couple days and then release them. And it is by far one of my most favorite things to do with the young children. It's not a Montessori work, right? Like it's just, but it is so much because each time, you know, they're fascinated because I'm fascinated. And we get to watch this process together and it's so beautiful. And the excitement that the children have when they walk in and all the caterpillars have spun into their chrysalis. And then we have to wait, you know, a few days or up to a week. And then they start emerging as butterflies and we watch as their wings grow strong. And it's this moment that's such a shared joy between the adult and the child, because you can't watch the process of metamorphosis and not be in awe. You know, just all. And so those kinds of experiences, I think, are so beautiful. And it's such a lovely way to connect with the child in that sense of wonder.
Beautiful. Oh, I've so enjoyed our conversation, Nicole. Is there anything that you wish that I had have asked you, or are you sucked dry for all of your wisdom?
You know, I think the last piece, maybe the last two pieces that I really love for adults to understand with children and things that they really need, and we touched on this a little bit, is this idea of positive attention. And, you know, young children really want our attention. They want to be with us. And the more positive attention we can give them, assurance, encouragement, telling them we love them, the less negative attention they seek. And I think sometimes we forget that the way that we counteract some of that negative behavior is not to go into the negative place with them, but it's really to come back into this positive place. And that's really helped serve me well over the years of working with toddlers, is reminding myself again, and I've said this so many times, that remembering they're not doing this to make me upset. And what they really need is to be reassured and not praised. You know, one of the words that I do not use in my classroom is good job. Instead, I say you did it. And it's a beautiful shift in language for the child. And then all of a sudden you hear this child in the corner doing something saying, I did it. And it's beautiful. It's like the best words. I could get it tattooed on my body someday. I did it. And then this idea of time. And I know that's something so precious to people and sometimes not available. But when we can, to give children time and time to be, time for them to be at their own pace. I love the idea of toddler-led walks where we just follow them and give them the opportunity to stop and look and feel and experience. And then the beautiful thing when we intentionally give time to the young child is that we slow down and it becomes this gift we're giving ourselves also. So I think having this idea of having intentional time with your child is so important, and scheduling that in if you're really busy is a great way to, again, really connect and show your child that you respect them and you value them. And I just love that. And I think it has the power to change the course of our world when we really show the young child that we respect and honor them.
Oh, I love that. Oh, this has been delightful. Nicole, I think that everyone will take away, you know, the way that you choose your words very intentionally, the way you spend your time very intentionally with them. And thank you again for joining us today.
You're welcome. This was so wonderful. I can talk about toddlers pretty much anytime all day. So this is as beneficial for me as it is, I hope, for the adults and parents and other guides listening. So thank you for having me. It's such an honor, Simone.
Oh, and I guess we should also say is that even though we did speak about toddlers a lot, all of these principles and the way we speak with children, that applies to any age. And particularly when, as they become teenagers, there's like definitely a parallel in development. And so you see a lot of these kind of things, like we think they're trying to wind us up, and actually it's exactly the same. They're not trying to give us a hard time, and they need sometimes guidance in these moments instead.
Absolutely.
So that was so much fun. I love talking to Nicole about toddlers and just how intentional she is with everything from her word choices to how she models for the children. And yes, it was a lot about toddlers, but these principles, as I said earlier in the episode, really apply with any age child, you know, really listening to them, being intentional with the words we choose and setting limits in that kind and loving way. So I hope you all found that really helpful. And now it's time for our listener question. And this week's question comes from Kerry. And Kerry asks, I was wondering about sharing and taking turns in a child with a language delay. She's turning 4 in April, but she's my first, so I don't know what is developmentally appropriate. I very much follow peaceful parenting at home, and she's doing well for the most part interacting with her brother who's 8 months old. But at school with other children her age, she will tantrum if she doesn't get what she wants. She's in a special ed preschool, which offers language services, but they are making me seem like she should not be acting this way. I've tried to give the school strategies that work for me, and I know that part of it is the overstimulation of the classroom and her not being able to fully express herself. Any advice on what I should be focusing on that she could maybe take with her to school? Thank you. So I chose this question as there are so many questions always about sharing, and I thought that perhaps we could start with some general tips on sharing and then get into the specifics of this question about a child with a language delay. And like, so when they're babies, sharing can mostly go okay. Our baby's playing with something and they offer it to us, or someone takes something from them and they turn around to play with something else instead. But around like 14, 16 months, they really want to start mastering what they're working on. So if you take it off them or take one of their pieces, they could really get upset. And so saying to a young child, we share toys, or, you know, everyone shares and plays together, it means that they have to give up on what they were working to master. And so instead, in a Montessori classroom, we generally share by taking turns. So once one child is finished, it goes back on the shelf, and then it's clear that it's available for the next child. And taking turns doesn't mean you have a turn, then I have a turn, then you have a turn, that kind of thing. It means they really get to finish the activity completely, like, which might even mean repeating it a few times until they're really done. And I actually think it's perfectly understandable to have a hard time sharing, and often use the example of my laptop. So like, say I was working in a cafe and someone takes it off me. I mean, the person sitting next to me wouldn't just say, oh, come on, we share our things. Instead, like, I could say, as soon as I'm finished this, you can have a turn. And then it still really might depend on how well I know the other person. So that said, do we need to step in every time to make sure that they take turns? And like, when I first finished my Montessori training, I was really strict on this. And there was one child per activity, and But now, really first I observe to see if they can work it out themselves. And older toddlers may even work out a way that they'll work on it together. So I don't want to step in and take away some creative possibilities, but I can also help them if they're having a hard time. So, especially if a child is always having their toys taken off them, I'd come and help them with their words to say something like, oh, would you like to say, oh, my turn, it will be available soon. And then I'm helping teach those skills for them to become more assertive. And it might take them a while to actually say those words, but they hear the words and they know that it's possible. And for example, if it's my child that's the one that's taken the toy, then I'd calmly say something like, oh, did you want a turn? It will be available soon. So I'm just very calm about it. I don't add any extra stress to the situation. And I observe to see then maybe if they need some help to stop touching it. And I could like maybe stand between them and the tempting object. Yet I also don't want to quickly distract them because they might still enjoy watching the other child. And that's okay too. And if I quickly distract them, then they know that I'm manipulating them in some kind of way and want to come back to what they were interested in and wanting to take off the other child. So I'd also really try to avoid taking it out of my child's hand to return it to them, other child, because then I'm kind of saying, oh, well, it's okay for me to take it out of your hand. So instead, I calmly show them maybe where to place the toy, like on the table. And then I really count silently in my head as they process the difficult task of letting it go. So I'm not allowed, but just in my head so that I maybe get to 10 or more to see if they can actually give the toy back to the person who they're taking it from. So we can have the same rule at home too, like that we share by taking turns. And I don't think we need two of everything. So siblings or twins never fight over toys, you know, and we'll really learn that they'll get a turn eventually. And they're learning the skill of waiting, of course, as well. At the playground, it can get a little bit more difficult because everyone has such different approaches to sharing. And sometimes we're also worried about like what another parent will think. So I still say, oh, they're just finishing their turn and you'll be next. And I found that as long as the child hears that they're going to get a turn next, then they're fine. And also acknowledges to a nearby parent that our child will be finishing soon and their child will get their turn. Okay, so back to the question then. A four-year-old could indeed still get quite upset by sharing. And as you said, especially if they've got a language delay, so it's difficult to express something that, you know, and express to someone like, oh, I'm going to be finished first. And, you know, it can be a stimulating environment as well. But I'd basically still apply the same principles, even with a child with a language delay. You know, I'd practice with her saying the same thing over and over again when the situation comes up. So for me, I might say something like, it'll be available soon. Or something, a phrase that you can repeat often so that she will always learn the same phrase. And then maybe the teachers can also learn to prompt her in the same way. Like, do you want to say it'll be available soon? And not every carer will understand, but it's also a lot of work for them. So maybe when you're able to, you can ask them how they're doing and give them empathy that it might be hard when she's having a tantrum over sharing. And then they'll really feel supported as well. And if there were no language delays, then I really try to empower the child themselves to handle things at school. At the most, like offering to come with them if they wanted to talk to the teacher and simply supporting them while they talk to the teacher rather than talking for them all the time. And you could try that even if she does have a language delay, which I think is what you were suggesting when you said, like, what can we work on that she can take to school? But I just wanted to remind others of that as well. So I hope this has been helpful, Kerry, and for anyone else dealing with any problems of sharing. And I'll also link to a blog post that I wrote a while ago about children having trouble sharing, and I'll include that into the show notes. So that's it for today. And next week will be our last episode for season one. And I'll be doing another Q&A episode to round out the season. There's so many I didn't get to yet, but feel free to try your luck and submit a question via my website over at themontessorinotebook.com. And if you click on the podcast tab, you'll find there are two buttons. One's for all the show notes from the whole season so far, and one to submit a listener question. So thank you so much for sharing your time with me today. I always love hearing about what you've learned from the episode, so be sure to tag me as you're listening, and I'll be back next Friday. So till then, everyone, keep well and stay positive.
Thanks for joining me for the Montessori Notebook podcast. The podcast was edited by Luke Davis from FilmProv Media and podcast art by Hiyoko Imai. To find out more about me and my online courses, visit themontessorinotebook.com, follow me on Instagram at themontessorinotebook, or pick up a copy of my book, The Montessori Toddler, from your local bookstore, Amazon, or where books are sold. It's also available as an ebook, audiobook, and has been translated into over 20 languages. I'll be back in a week with more Montessori inspiration, and in the meantime, perhaps you'll join me in spreading some more peace and positivity around the world.